Thank you very much, Ross. I like biting off more than I can chew because it's so good once you get it all chewed. Well, somebody suggested that I ask shorter questions. And the answer is no, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to ask the question as the question comes about. And that's just how it is, because as I stated earlier, no matter what you do, somebody's going to have a problem with it. Okay? And as far as this character, let me tell you something. You can send me any kind of an email you want, but the moment that it starts waxing moronic, it gets deleted. Now, I'm not talking to 99.999% of the listeners out there, but it's like, listen closer and reserve your opinion until you've heard it all. That way, your email will make some sense. In the meantime, hit me with some more of them, John B. at coasttocoastam.com. We shall return for the final hour, including your calls with Dr. Lawrence M. Krauss, who wrote the book, A Universe from Nothing, on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Krauss, I got a question for you. What are the chances of a state, not necessarily of existence, but just a state beyond the veil, you know, behind the veil of what we see? Our eyes are designed to see only certain frequencies. So somewhere in the area that we cannot see, no matter what kind of an instrument we use, what are the chances that something is there where neither space nor time exists? Or do these virtual particles that you mentioned earlier already exist in that state?
Well, there's certainly a great likelihood that there are things that you can't see. There's much more to the universe than meets the eye. And that's why we design detectors to be able to see lots of things you can't see, X-rays, infrared radiation. There's a whole universe of things that our eyes can't see. But the good thing is that we can design detectors to extend our own senses to be able to see them. We can't see the virtual particles that are there because the fundamental limits of physics tell us we can't measure time intervals so short as to see them. They exist by definition over time intervals that are too short to observe. But nevertheless, our notions of time and space at this point persist on those scales. It may be when we get to the smallest scales of nature, the scale where quantum mechanics and gravity have to come together, where we don't yet have a good theory, it may be that on that scale, the notions of space and time, as we now understand them, may have to be redefined or thrown out altogether. But at this point, for all the scales we can measure with our large accelerators, from the smallest scales we measure at the Large Hadron Collider to the largest scales we measure with the Hubble Space Telescope, say, the notions of space and time seem to work. But what is absolutely true and what is so fascinating is there's much more to the universe than meets the eye. And it's those very discoveries that I try and celebrate in the new book.
All right, very good. You know, a fellow, a fellow named Rush just sent an interesting email. I think it's interesting. Isn't it really, really smart of all those random particles of dust out there to first form an inner molten core of only uranium, iron, and nickel, then start adding the carbon and the silicon and aluminum and magnesium and all of this? I mean,
well, what are they talking about? That's not the way the Earth formed, and it's certainly not the way the sun forms. We understand these things. It's amazing how, and what one of the things that I talk about in the book, which to me is one of the most poetic things in the universe and something that I hope everyone will eventually understand, is that you are literally stardust. The atoms in your body came from stars that exploded, because it turns out in the Big Bang, the only elements that were created were hydrogen, which is basically just protons, helium, and lithium. And the important elements, well, lithium may be important to some of your listeners, but the more important are carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, iron. And those are only created in the cores of stars. And the only way they could get into your body is if the stars were kind enough to explode. Stars explode about once every 100 years per galaxy. All those heavy elements were created in the nuclear furnaces inside of stars, and there are atoms in your left hand that come from different stars than your right hand. And I find that so cosmically inspiring, the notion that we are all stardust, and that every atom in our body has experienced one of the most violent cosmic explosions in nature, a supernova explosion, is truly, truly remarkable and something that's worth celebrating and telling your friends about.
Excellent. Would you like to take a call?
Sure, I'd love to.
Well, let's talk to Bill in West Hartford on the wild card line. Bill, come up on the bridge and talk with Dr. Krause.
Yes, hi, John. Hi. This is my first time talking to you, John, personally, and welcome to Saturday night.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Krause, hi. I'm an amateur astronomer and an atheist myself because I am an amateur astronomer, and I have two fantastic questions to ask you that relates to your book, which essentially says, why is there something other than nothing? I'll ask them together and then listen to you, your answer. Question number one, could something be another form or another aspect of nothing, and could nothing be another form or another aspect of something? Meaning, could nothing as well as something be different forms of the same thing? And question number two, which relates to biology but relates to what you're talking about, because I'm an atheist, Christ is the myth, and because my point is, the Virgin Mary in the myth had conception of some kind with supposedly God or the Holy Spirit. My point is, using biology, the egg of Mary, even though it's a myth, the egg of Mary is two X's, is a woman. You did not have a man with an X and a Y chromosome having sex with Mary. Therefore, the offspring of Mary, namely Jesus, if he existed, he would be a she. It would be a woman. And since Jesus has never been said to have been a woman, he's supposedly a male, it cannot happen. A virgin birth has to produce only a female. Therefore,
wow.
Jesus did not exist, as well as there were previous religions before Christianity where gods died for the believers and were crucified as well and went to heaven in 3 days also.
Oh, okay. Let's see. Let's take the first question first. In some sense, that it's a good question, because in some sense, one of the points that I'm trying to describe in the book is that our definitions of something and nothing are very different than what people thought before. And yes, because something can turn into nothing, in some sense, there's physical connections between them. Other people's nothing can easily turn into something, and therefore, there are different versions, if you wish, of the same thing. A space with nothing in it versus a space with lots of stuff in it, combined with negative gravitational potential energy, can turn into one another. And of course, therefore, there's relationships between something and nothing, just like Einstein tells us energy and mass are related. I can take matter and turn it into radiation, and so they're related, even though they're very, very different. So yes, something and nothing are much more related than you'd think before, and that's why the question, why is there something rather than nothing, is really not only not the right question, perhaps, but not very surprising, because nothing often turns into something, as I describe in the book. So I think that absolutely the modern physics tells us we have to be much more careful with those notions, and those antiquated notions from philosophy and theology have to be thrown out and replaced by operational terms that are based on what we actually know about the universe. As far as your questions about Jesus and Mary and Christ, I mean, I don't view the Bible as a biblical, as a scientific document, and I don't worry if there are a host of contradictions if you take the doctrines literally, and I think I suspect most people take those things that they find difficult to swallow and throw them out. Most people don't. I think they adopt their theology to what their preferences actually are, and so I don't really feel the need to comment on the genetic problems associated with a virgin birth. There's never been a virgin birth anywhere else, and there's no evidence that there was one then, as much as anything else. So I don't take it seriously enough to actually worry about those particular contradictions, because there are a host of other contradictions.
All right. Alan, Hollywood, Wild 2. Are you there?
Hello. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hello. I was answering what you just said, that actually Krishna was born of a virgin. Also, if maybe you don't know that, but
well, actually, in almost every religion, they have a story very similar to the myth of the birth of Christ. Yeah, it's nothing new. The Christians borrowed very heavily from earlier religions. Absolutely.
Yes, and you know, the concept of existence and non-existence, you know, can seem baffling, but you know, in ancient Buddhist texts and it's sort of a reflection. One is a reflection of the other. And I wanted to ask you, will we ever reach the outskirts of infinity?
Well, I don't make predictions about the future. We have gone much further than I would have ever imagined, even when I was a graduate student. And I suspect that in an infinite universe, there will be things forever beyond our reach. But the universe surprises us. So I think what we can do is keep on traveling. I liken at the end of my book to the myth of Sisyphus. Kim's myth of Sisyphus, which, you know, Sisyphus was a Greek mythological character, doomed for eternity to roll a rock up a hill, and just before getting to the top, the rock would roll down the bottom, and he'd have to start over again. And Camus said, "I imagine Sisyphus is smiling," and I think so too. The search is worth the effort, even if the rock keeps rolling down the hill. I don't know if we'll get out there. We just got to keep trying.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Greg in Muncie, Indiana. Are you there, sir?
Yes. Hi, John. Good show tonight. Dr. Krauss, I have a couple quick questions for you, and I'll take your answers off the air. But my first question is, if quantum physics accepts the idea that a particle can exist in more than one place at the same time, why does the act of measuring that particle keep it from continuing in that state? And the other question I had is, what do you think about the research, I believe, out of the University of Arizona, claiming that the human brain is a quantum computer?
Yeah, okay. Those are both good questions. Well, the answer is that it depends on the nature of measurement. When you measure an electron to be and you see a, you know, you see a dot on a cathode ray tube or a screen where the electron hits and causes it to fluoresce, then you've measured it at that point. It doesn't constrain its future motion. So there's certain measurements you can make that later on constrain completely the system to remain in that state. There are other measurements that don't. And so if I measure a particle at time t to be at point x, depending on the type of measurement, that doesn't tell me that later on it can't be once again in many different places at many different times. At that instant, I've constrained it to be there, but I don't constrain its future motion. So there are other configurations where if I measure this an electron to be spinning in a certain direction in a magnetic field, I can once I've done it and once I preserve it and stop it from interacting with anything else, I do in some sense force it to be in that state. So it depends on the type of measurement you do. The way you constrain the future in quantum mechanics depends upon the type of measurement you do. Now, as far as this purported research from Arizona, I think it's nonsensical. I've briefly talked to one of the people who's not a physicist, who claims that somehow quantum mechanics allows things to happen, you to think of things before they happen, or I don't see any sense to it. And I know that they're interested in it, but I think it's a misunderstanding and a misapplication of quantum mechanics. And I certainly don't see that it's had any relevance or any impact on any other research. So I think it's just a red herring.
Well, all right. Let's see here. Someone asked a question a while ago that has the speed that these galaxies, I presume that these galaxies are also in some sort of a rotation or not?
Well, with each other?
Well, yeah, the same way that the planets orbit the sun.
Yeah, our sun orbits around our galaxy once every 200 million years. Now, galaxies tend not to orbit around each other. They do. Certain galaxies are in bound systems. The motion tends to be a little more chaotic because there's enough of them that they're sort of moving around randomly. It isn't a nice smooth orbit. But our galaxy does the disk of our galaxy does an orbit about once every 200 million years, and our sun does that every 200 million years around our galaxy.
Has its speed been estimated?
Yeah, it's about 200 kilometers per second, and in miles, that's about 120 miles per second it's traveling around our galaxy.
Okay, so it's nowhere near light speed.
No. Nowhere near light speed. The rotational speed is not anywhere near light speed, which is why we can often use sort of straightforward Newtonian arguments to try and understand it. We don't get to light speeds until we talk about the expansion of the universe on the very largest scales.
Well, what's the speed of light again? 360,000 meters per second or something? What is it?
Well, it depends upon, I mean, in units that are probably relevant to most of the listeners, it's a 186 million miles per second.
Okay, gotcha. Oh, is that all? That's pretty fast.
Yeah.
Okay, well, if one of these, let's just take a hypothetical, one of these galaxies or any galaxy managed to...
I've got to make sure I got that right, because I always work in meters per second, but I'm pretty sure I got that right. Anyway, it's in meters, let me just say it's 300 million meters per second, so that's okay. The way to do it, so it's okay.
What's all this about a potential time reversal if the speed of light is met or exceeded? Is that still a viable theory?
Sorry, it's 186 million miles per hour now. I remember that conversion. But anyway, sorry. In terms of time going backwards, if you go faster than light?
Yeah.
Well, in principle, that's true in the sense that different observer, if an object were traveling faster than light, different observers would observe that object. One observer might move that object. Observe that object moving forward in time, but another would observe it moving backward in time. And that's one of the many reasons why real things we don't think move faster than light.
Does Einstein's theory still hold with current thinking?
Absolutely. It explains every observation we can make. Now, there, as you may have heard, there was a claim of an experiment in Geneva in Switzerland, the Large Hadron Collider, that claimed that potentially these particles called neutrinos were traveling faster than light from Geneva to a detector in a tunnel in Italy by 60 nanoseconds. Now, the point is, it's most likely wrong because it tends to disagree with most other experiments. And there are many, many good reasons to think it could be wrong. It's a very complicated apparatus. And light travels, all you need is about 30 extra meters of cable that's not accounted for somewhere, and you can account for the 60 nanosecond delay in light versus neutrinos. So it's worth being very, very skeptical of that result. It's very, very unlikely to be correct. Of course, it would be fascinating because it would, but it's most likely incorrect. And people should realize that most experiments at the forefront, when we're at the limits of our sensitivity, come up with spurious results all the time because we're at the limits of our sensitivity. I like to say I'm pretty certain the experiment's wrong because nothing ever arrives early in Italy.
Right. Right. Listen, we're coming up on a hard break, but just Einstein's theory that there is no universal time, there are only local times, that still holds?
Yes. Time is observer dependent. Your clock depends upon where you are and what you're doing.
Observer dependent.
Yeah, in fact, if I'm at a slightly higher altitude or lower altitude than you, my clock is ticking at a different rate. Not enough that our clocks, neither your clock or mine is sensitive enough to measure it, but GPS detectors depend upon that every day. The satellites, you wouldn't be able to, I wrote an article once, you wouldn't be able to navigate your way around Los Angeles or wherever you are if we didn't use that fact of relativity that the different satellites are at different altitudes and traveling at different speeds. We have to compensate for that fact to make it work.
Excellent. Let's carry on. This has been a fast 2.5 hours, and we're going to come back with some more calls and more with Dr. Lawrence M. Krauss, A Universe from Nothing, when Coast to Coast AM continues. I'm on the outside looking inside, or are we on the inside looking outside, or are they one and the same? And what difference does it make anyway? It's all part of the journey, isn't it? The destination is the part I'm a little concerned about. We'll finish up our discussion this evening with, this morning, with Dr. Lawrence Krauss, a learned and rational man. He has his viewpoints on things, and you have yours. So if you'd like to share them, we will take as many of your calls as possible, and as much of a shameless promotion as this may seem to be, it isn't really shameless. It's something that I think that you will like, and that is to consider becoming a Coast Insider. 1,000 shows, 3 years worth of archive shows. You can listen to anytime you want, and it's very, very inexpensive and easily affordable. So consider becoming a member, and stay with us for our final segment on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Krauss, James in Indiana has been holding on the line for a while. Let's see what kind of a question he has. James, come up on the bridge and talk to us.
Yes, hi. Hi. This is my first time caller. Can you hear me?
We'll be gentle. Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
All right. Is it okay if I ask two questions?
Hit me.
Sure.
Okay. My first one is this. When you were discussing the possibility and likely or unlikeliness of intelligent design, and you said how evolution was the natural occurrence of a process that happens in nature by itself, I was thinking, can't chaotic systems in actuality be engineered? You know, like AI learning programs or board games with cards that you draw or the double pendulum?
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, well, I'll answer that question first if you want. Well, look, yeah, chaotic systems can be engineered, but the point is that if there's no evidence of engineering, then you don't have to, it's an extra assumption to assume it. And in this case, we understand perfectly well, given the way genetics works and the predictions we make based on evolutionary biology agree with every observation we've ever made over 150 years of a process by which a distribution of gene of a population with a distribution of genes can evolve in a natural way. So yeah, there can always be something that sets that system up, but it without evidence of that, it's an additional hypothesis that doesn't add anything.
Well, the only reason I mentioned that question was like somebody mentioned something to me once that stuck, and they compared us to compared humans to say angels. You know, as far as intelligence go, how much we are smarter than a bird.
Well, sometimes we are, sometimes we're not, but yeah.
Well, sort of that comparison. No matter how many birds land in your backyard, you're still smarter than all of them combined.
Well, some of them can navigate around the world, and I couldn't. But I think the big difference is that birds exist, and as far as I can tell, angels don't. So,
okay. And my other question is, since we cannot move or see or measure anything past the speed of light, which is why its limit seems constant to me, if we can't see past that, and you mentioned briefly about negative and positive energy, mm-hmm. gravity and anti-gravity, how do we know that there aren't things as exotic as, say, particles or objects with negative masses out there whose rest mass is non-existent? They have to exceed the speed of light, whereby it would be just as difficult for them to slow down as it is for us, positive masses, to accelerate.
They're called tachyons.
They're called tachyons
in physics or in Star Trek. Well, the answer is, look, we can't rule out the possibility of things that might possibly exist. What we can say is there's no evidence that they do. We've searched in cosmic rays, and we get the most exotic particles from across the universe coming at us in cosmic rays, and we look for these kind of things. We look for faster-than-light particles. We look for particles with weird properties. We look for it not because we want to preserve the theories we have, but because we want to discover new things about nature. And there's no evidence of it. That's all we can say, is that there's no evidence that those things exist, and we scoured the universe looking for them. But we can't say that something we haven't yet seen doesn't exist unless it violates the laws of physics. And there are careful constraints on what might be possible for such tachyons, and we know the particles we measure in nature aren't that way. And so there are careful constraints, but of the particles, you know, when we look for these kind of things, we haven't ever observed them in cosmic rays and accelerators or coming from anywhere in the universe. And so, once again, there's a lot we don't know about the universe. We have to recognize that fact. But there's a lot we do know. And the things that we've tested aren't going to be violated. We can't allow particles that violate the rules that already work because we've tested those rules. When it comes to the limits of what we know, of course, then much greater set of possibilities open up. But bottom line, once again, is we've no evidence that such things exist at this point, having scoured the universe looking for them.
All right, very good. Very good. Interesting questions and very interesting answers. Let's see, who do we have here? West of the Rockies, Jack in California, out there somewhere in California. It's a big state. Don't know where you are in California, but come on up on the bridge and talk to us.
This is Jack in Willits, California.
All right.
And as I was waiting to get on, I scribbled something on the pad here. Believers are positive that they know something, that they know what is, and atheists are positive that they know what isn't. And the difference between those two is that believers have an abundance of faith and atheists have an abundance of hubris. Now, let me go on from that.
Hello?
Did we lose him?
I think he, yeah, he got, we lost it. You know, I'm happy to comment on that if you want.
Go ahead.
I think that true believers believe in. My problem with the thing is assuming the answer before you know the question. If you know what's right before you ask how things actually work, then your mind is forever going to be closed. So, being absolutely certain of that you possess the truth without ever having explored it is, I think, the ultimate hubris. I think most people who call themselves atheists are really saying they find what they find the preponderance of the evidence to suggest to them that there's no God. You're right, it is hubris to say with absolute certainty that there's no purpose or intelligence behind the universe. But what you can say is, given what you know about the universe and the lack of such evidence, it's unlikely. And I think that's a reasonable statement. And as I say, I personally fall in that camp, and rather than to claim that I know everything about the universe.
Let's see. Is that am I seeing Larry in Jacksonville, LA Control, first time caller?
Yes, you do.
Oh, come on board. How are you?
I'm great. First time caller. Love the show. I love you, guy. You are amazing. But I have a quick comment and a question. My comment is to the doctor, based off of your words that the Bible was written by illiterate peasants, wouldn't it be highly unlikely that they could somehow write one of the most famous books in the entire world and sell it? Well, they wouldn't sell it, but people would sell it, and it would be one of the biggest books ever if there wasn't some sort of divine intervention. I mean, it wouldn't make really any sense if there was nothing from nothing, and all of a sudden, this fake book by illiterate peasants could be written, and it could sell to just about everyone in the world.
I think the point is that religion is deeply based in human culture, and people really want to believe. So, how the sociology and history of how certain beliefs are held is remarkable, and it goes in different societies. The fact that societies believed in Zeus or Thor or Odin for periods longer than our society has been around in some cases is remarkable, and we now look at those beliefs and say, well, those are quaint, but they didn't have it right. And I'm not so. I think it's again, it's not surprising that certain religious beliefs and certain things that are written down get followers because people want to believe. Just because something's popular doesn't make it right. And sometimes when I look at the books that are popularly written and sell a lot, I often wonder about that. And so I think it's not the Bible. The fact that it's got a lot of adherence is remarkable. And same with the Quran. And it is a property of the human psyche that people want to believe and coalesce around certain beliefs. But it's happened throughout human history for beliefs which are completely mutually inconsistent, for gods that are completely mutually inconsistent. So it's fascinating. I agree with you, but I don't think it points to anything fundamental.
All right. Let's see. Michael. Let's see. Yes. Michael in Virginia, east of the Rahway, east of the Rockies. Come on board.
Thank you so much. Lawrence Krauss, Dr. Lawrence Krauss, I remember you many years ago on this program with Art Bell when he was interviewing. Is that correct?
That's correct. I go way back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, way back. And in fact, I still have those programs, or that one program at least. What I like about you is the fact that you like Christopher Hitchens. He always impressed me from the very first time I heard him. The greatest political debater I ever heard. I would never miss him if I heard he was on. I would stop anything I was doing to hear Christopher Hitchens.
I agree with you.
Your theory I just want to test it a little bit because I agree with you, too, about the problems with religion. But if we have a God who really doesn't care, which you suggest would be the only kind of God that you want.
No, I don't even want that kind of God. But anyway, go on.
You wouldn't even want a God who doesn't care about you?
Yeah, I don't care about it. I'd rather have nothing at all, yeah.
Okay, well, if you'd rather have nothing at all, I don't know why you said you'd rather have a God that...
I'd rather have a God that didn't care than a God that cared, but I'd rather have no God at all than a God that... Anyway, it's semantics. Let's move on.
Okay. So if the second best God that you would choose is one that doesn't care at all, I'm wondering what your application of that attitude would be towards other human beings. Would you rather live in a world where no human being cares about another human being?
Absolutely not.
Well,
but I don't see. I mean, look, you know, there's no logical connection between the two. I observe other human beings, and I observe them. I don't observe a God. I don't observe a universe that has any such characteristics. And I also wouldn't want to live in a world, I suppose, where all the frogs in the world were watching me. I don't see the connection.
Oh, sorry to cut him off, but let's go with Ken in Seattle because we're getting running very short on time. Thanks for the call, pal.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Krause, am I on?
Hi.
You are.
Okay. I just wanted to bring up that it seems to me that a lot of people have a problem where they believe that when people talk about evolution or planetary development or cosmic development, that means randomness and random mutation when it comes to evolution.
You're right.
And I think they're taking out of context a term, random mutation.
Absolutely.
And that's only one kind of mutation. When you're passing your genes from generation to generation, you've got a kind of deliberate mutation that's impacted by your parents' genetics and the environment that they live in, and the environment that you grow up in affects your genetics as you develop. And people have a problem that when they try to debate against atheists, as if there should be a debate, I don't think there should be.
Uh-huh.
But when they do, they're always saying, well, how can randomness explain the complexity of an eyeball? How can randomness explain this? How can it explain that? No one's trying to say, that I know of, that randomness explains any of this.
Absolutely. Evolution is anything but random. I mean, that's the whole point. It's when you have natural selection, a system is driven to in a certain direction. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the word mutation, randomness, goes about in part of the process, but the process itself is anything but random. And you're absolutely right. Those people who argue that having a human being is like having all these parts of a 747 in a junkyard and the wind blows and produces a 747 just don't understand the fact that evolution and natural selection is anything but a random process. You're right.
Excellent.
Very long periods of time. Hundreds of millions of years and how many generations, let's say it with humans, how many generations that entails as we develop. And I also wanted to bring up that searching for life, I think people need, you know, out in the universe, people need to kind of differentiate between searching for life versus searching for intelligent life.
Absolutely.
Versus searching for any life whatsoever. Because, for instance, if we were to run across a planet at some point where the most intelligent life that we could identify with would be equivalent to Native Americans of 300 or 400 years ago, I think that would be basically the same thing as finding mirror images of ourselves, but they wouldn't be transmitting any radio signals out into space.
Absolutely. I mean, your point is well taken. I've written about this. I mean, even if intelligent life exists, the likelihood of detecting it is extremely small. If someone told someone on a distant star to look for life on Earth, and that civilization had been around for 5 billion years, during most of the history of the life on Earth, they would have no evidence of intelligence. Only the last few years, since we've been emitting radio waves, would they detect us. So it's going to be extremely difficult to find intelligent life, even if it exists. As opposed to life, I suspect we'll find evidence for at least fossilized life on other planets in our solar system, perhaps Mars or the oceans of some of the moons of Jupiter, etc. But it's going to be it's a long slog, and I guess the point to say is that not having heard anything does not mean it's not there. It's just a big universe, very difficult to detect, and civilizations may exist for only a short time during those periods. And so you're absolutely right. The odds are against it. I would argue, I suspect it's unlikely, even if intelligence exists elsewhere in the universe, that we'll ever know about it. But once again, it's still worth listening.
Chris in South Korea, come on real quick. You got about 1 minute.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you very much. You have a very interesting show tonight.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up the fact that we spent most of the night talking about Western religion versus science, and of course, because we're Westerners. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about Eastern philosophy, and specifically Taoism and its relation to physics, and I'll take that off the air.
Okay, thanks. Well, I mean, you're right. We tend to be a little myopic when we're talking about it. Look, there's been I think there are fascinating aspects of various aspects of Eastern religion that, and some people have overstated the connections between Taoism and physics, and there have even been books written on that I think overstate those connections. I think to the extent that the statements are vague, one can often find concurrence between some of those statements and some of the statements in physics, but I think that's largely, frankly, accidental. To the extent that they don't involve a creator, but involve observations of nature, I think there's obviously concurrence.
We got to go.
Anyway, okay.
I hate to tell you this. We have to do this again sometime. Dr. Yeah. Lawrence M. Krauss, thank you very, very much for staying with us for these 3 hours.
It's been a pleasure.
To bail. It sure has been a pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks to our guests tonight, James Childs and Dr. Lawrence Krauss, George Norrie, Lisa Lyon, George Knapp, Ian Robb, and the L.A. crew, and especially you, the best listeners on this or any other planet, and I do mean from all over the planet. Until next Saturday night, this is John B. Wells saying, you be well too. Good night.